listening to the U LaSalle Student Entrepreneurship Podcast. I'm your host, Jay Abubo. We'll be talking with our students, alumni, and other high-impact innovators of the University of Utah campus, our Utah community, and our world. Today, I'll be speaking with David Toledo, co-founder of Power Practical, co-inventor of the infamous Power Pot of Shark Tank fame, and other innovations within the recreational market. David, welcome to U LaSalle Student Entrepreneur.
Hi, Jay. Thanks for having me.
It's really interesting to me that the Power Practical offices and studio space are just blocks away from West High School in Salt Lake City, where you, David, attended high school. While in high school, did you ever see yourself being the inventor of innovative technologies that you are today?
No, I would say in high school, I wasn't thinking about that at all. I always knew I wanted to do something science tech related. I've always been into biology, physics, chemistry, whatever, all throughout high school, but I definitely didn't think I was going to become an inventor, so to speak.
What were you interested in while you were in high school that, in retrospect, paved the way to what you're doing today?
So I've always really enjoyed taking things apart, for whatever reason, and learning how they work. In high school, I mostly studied like biology and thought I was going to be going into some bioengineering, biomedical field. I actually started at the university as a biology student. And then before I went to my first class, I switched to physics. And then within my first semester, I switched to material science engineering and then stuck with that.
You went to study material science and engineering at the University of Utah from 2006 to 2010. What subjects fascinated you while you were in school?
Electronics, definitely, specifically for energy purposes. During my entire undergraduate degree, I worked at the Nanomaterials Research Laboratory in the Material Science Department under Dr. Ashutosh Tiwari. I worked on various energy-related material research projects, ranging from different parts of solar panels, and ended up doing my senior thesis on thermoelectric materials. And that's where the inspiration for the Power Pot came from.
What is the Power Pot?
So technically speaking, the Power Pot is a thermoelectric generator. And so what are thermoelectrics? Thermoelectrics are materials that take a temperature difference and create electricity with no moving parts. So you have photovoltaics or solar panels that take sunlight and make electricity with no moving parts. This is the analogous technology for heat.
According to the Power Practical website, you had prototyped the Power Pot, Power Practical's first technological darling, for several years before you brought it to market. Were you creating the Power Pot while attending the U as an undergrad?
Yes. So when I was doing my undergrad at the University of Utah, I was doing research on thermoelectric materials, but the research I was doing was really fundamental. We were looking for new thermoelectric materials. We were making things no one had made before and then studying their properties. So at the end of the day, what that means is I was spending a lot of the time in a chemistry lab making different things and a lot, even more time characterizing them using, you know, electrical measurements and x-rays and electron microscopes and whatever all. And that's all kind of nebulous. I mean, it's great, it's interesting, but what I wanted was to play with a thermoelectric generator. So what I did is I got on the internet and I put in a thermoelectric generator and see if I could buy one. And there was nothing out there. It wasn't like a solar panel where I could buy a little folding solar panel and play with that and see how it works and tangibly feel it in my hands, see how much it weighs, how responsive it is, whatever you want to do with it. There was nothing like that for thermoelectric generators. So I set out to build my own thermoelectric generator to see what I could do because I'm a very practical person. I like applied technologies. While I do enjoy doing fundamental research, I wanted to know why I was doing this research. I wanted to make a thermoelectric generator.
So how does this desire for a thermoelectric generator turn into the Power Pot, a tool that can charge your phone, cook food, such that it's ideal for outdoor recreation?
When I set out to make a thermoelectric generator, I did not set out to make the Power Pot. I bought lots of parts and pieces off of eBay and just played around with them because it's little known, but thermoelectrics are actually widely used throughout the world for cooling. the pieces that are the working part of any thermoelectric system. So what I did is I bought some of those thermoelectric cooling modules, and I knew from my schooling that you can run them in reverse as a generator. And I just started playing around with them, like literally broke dozens and dozens of them. And my whole goal was to see how much power I could get out of a thermoelectric module and different ways of doing that. So, you know, started out with taking a thermoelectric module and sticking on a block of aluminum and hitting it with a blowtorch and seeing what happens. They melt, and no surprise, but, you know, from there it got refined down to let's try using a fan to cool it, or let's try and do this or that to cool it, because for a thermoelectric you need not only a hot side, but you need a cold side. You need a gradient of temperature. So concurrently, while I was doing my research at the University of Utah, I was taking a thermodynamics course. I was learning about boiling water and different properties of water, and it dawned on me, hey, I can make a cold side that stays the same temperature all the time by using boiling water as my cold side temperature, because water never gets hotter than a boil and then it turns into steam. So that's where the inspiration for putting on a cooking pot came from, was, hey, I have a flame that I'm always using to heat up the water, and then I have water which never gets hotter than boiling.
That was your aha moment.
Yeah. And then there was lots and lots of iterations of how to do that. Like the first power pot, it really wasn't a power pot, barely worked at all, but the thermoelectrics were in the pot, submerged in the water. And then it's like, oh, well, we should take the modules out of the pot and put them on the bottom of the pot, in between the pot and the flame. That was really the aha moment, if you will, whereas we had a pot that was generating a lot of electricity. You know, we hooked up our little voltmeter, and before we were getting 1, 2, maybe 3 volts, and then all of a sudden we had this pot that was generating 30-40 volts, and you could actually, you know, create sparks in between the wires. That was cool. And that was just done at my house, like not at the University of Utah. It was done in my basement, primarily at the house I was renting during college.
You mentioned we a lot. Would that we be your co-inventor and co-founder of Power Practical, Paul Slessor?
Yes, we were working in the same lab at the University of Utah for Dr. Tiwari. And then we got along really well. So sophomore year, junior year, something, we rented a house together and we started tinkering on the power pot together in our basement.
According to an article published in Entrepreneur, June 2016, this year, Power Practical raised more than $1.5 million through 6 Kickstarter campaigns. Could you tell us more about each of these 6 Kickstarter campaigns?
Yeah, so the first Kickstarter campaign was for the Power Pot, and that was in April of 2012. Kickstarter was relatively young then. Most of the products that had been, or projects that had been on there were more artsy, if you will, like either dance or books or music related. And doing products on Kickstarter was just starting to catch on. April of 2012 was the first one for the Power Pot. That was $126,000. And that's really what got this company off the ground. And then the following year, we did another one for a little device where called a practical meter, which shows you how much power you're getting into your device from a source. So really nerdy, but at the time, if you were trying to charge your iPhone off a Mac or your iPhone off a PC, they charged very differently and it wasn't clear why. So we developed this meter that would show you how fast your phone is charging off a power source, and then these cables that would maximize how fast your device is charging. That was actually directly a result of the Power Pot. And all of our Kickstarter campaigns, each subsequent one pretty much has been the result of a previous one. While we were building the Power Pots from the 2012 campaign, we realized there's all these weird things going on with different phones charging from the Power Pot. We can figure it out. And then we realized, oh, there's all these different charging standards for phones. And we made this meter that we built into the Power Pot for the next generation that will show you how fast your phone is charging. The third campaign was for a larger version of the Power Pot called the Power Pot 10. It's just both physically larger so you could cook for more people and generate twice as much power. That was when, you know, tablets and phablets were getting more popular. After that, we did a fast charge battery called the Pronto. The inspiration for the fast charge battery was where we had the Power Pot 10, for example, where we could generate 10 to 15 watts of power. But a lot of phones or devices would only charge at 2 or 5 watts of power, and a few like iPads would charge at 10. So we were thinking, what can we do with this excess power? With the Pronto series batteries, they charge really fast. So they charge a lot faster than any of the standard batteries. One charges 5 times faster than an iPhone, one charges 12 times faster. The idea was, one, to use it with the PowerPot, and two, to be able to plug it into the wall and really just suck power into this battery pack that you could carry around with you. So if you woke up in the morning, your cell phone's dead, you plug it into the wall normally, and then you take a shower and you gotta leave in 10 minutes, you have like 5-10% of your battery. Well, with the Pronto, you plug it into the wall, after 5-10 minutes, you have enough power stored in the battery to charge your iPhone all the way while you're on the go.
So that was the fourth product?
That was the fourth one, yes. So first one, PowerPot. Second one, Practical Meter. Third one, PowerPot 10, bigger PowerPot. And then the fourth one, the Pronto batteries.
Before going on to the fifth and sixth Kickstarter campaign products, how did you know what products you wanted to make in each phase? What informed your need to go on to Kickstarter and crowdfund?
Well, crowdfunding offers a lot of value, more than just the money that you get out of it. There's the marketing aspect, for example, where it's hard for a small company like us to get a lot of attention, but when you run a Kickstarter campaign, all of a sudden you start getting a lot of attention because you're doing a Kickstarter. The other thing is product validation, and that's the number one reason why we put things on Kickstarter, really, which is we don't want to start making something until we know people want to buy it. So with Kickstarter, it allows you to make a prototype, just make a couple of these things, and then put them on Kickstarter and see if people are going to buy it before you invest a lot of time and money into it.
Is it actually more of a pre-sale for you guys?
Yeah. I mean, in general, Kickstarters are pre-sales.
What were the fifth and sixth products that you marketed and did pre-sales for on Kickstarter?
So the fifth and sixth were both LED lights, and they're called the Luminoodle, because it's a kind of a noodly light. It's a strip of lights. And the inspiration for that was we want to make a tent light, because if you've gone camping a lot, then you know you end up spending time in the tent a lot of the times, like bad weather at night or whatever. Using a headlamp to read a book or play cards in a tent just does not work well, because you get a bright spot and then everything around it's dark, and you try and put it in the pocket of your tent and then it's like facing out of the tent, and it just doesn't work great. So we wanted to make a practical tent light that was bright enough to read a book by. That's where the Luminoodle came from. It's a 5-foot long waterproof flexible LED strip that just plugs into any of our battery packs. Or if you wanted to run it off the PowerPot directly, you could do that too. But
yeah, just, you know, use both.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, just get them all.
Because you're going to be cooking. Yeah. You might as well do it.
You can use the PowerPot to charge the battery pack and use the battery pack to light your tent later. The Luminoodle was the fifth campaign. And then the sixth campaign is a color-changing version of the Luminoodle. And it also includes a remote, so.
Pretty Burning Man.
Yeah, I've been told it's playa proof.
What's that?
The burn is done on a playa, and they refer to things as being playa proof. I've never been a Burning Man myself, but that's what the burners tell me.
During your product development phase, when did you know it was time to get the word out there about a product that you were working on at Power Practical?
For our product development cycle, how it goes is more or less we come up with an idea, then we do a bunch of prototyping, really rough stuff, usually involves buying stuff on Amazon or eBay that's similar, tearing it apart and seeing if we can do what we think we can do. If that first phase validates and we are like, okay, you know, we can use this technology to meet this end, then we make a prettier version, like a more full-fledged prototype, make sure that our design, we like the design that we've come up with. And then before we invest a bunch of time and money into doing a full production run of that product, we take those prototypes and we create a Kickstarter campaign around them and put it on Kickstarter and see, you know, does the crowd like this product? Are people going to buy it? And then if it goes well on Kickstarter, then we'll get it made.
What's essential when designing a successful Kickstarter campaign?
Building a Kickstarter campaign is definitely a very involved and complicated process. But I would say the best place to start is you need to know why you're doing it. And that seems silly, but because I want to make $1 million is not a reason to do a Kickstarter campaign. You know, for us, it's we're doing a Kickstarter campaign because we want to know if within this time period we can sell this many pieces or else this product just isn't viable to us. A more creative project, like a film or something, you need to know why you want to make that film. You have to have a reason for doing it, both your own reason and then the reason you're telling people, which should definitely be aligned with each other. You have to have kind of a story. So for example, with Illuminoodle, obviously for myself, I'm putting it on Kickstarter because I want to see if it will sell. But the reason we made the Illuminoodle is so you could have a light that's waterproof and flexible and you can put in your tent easily and you can read a book by. We had that story. We feel there's this need for a light for a tent. That's the story we told on Kickstarter. Ask yourself, why are you doing the project that you're doing? And then be able to communicate that to other people clearly in like 2 minutes or less.
Your stories had engaged Kickstarter fans and backers from 2012 to 2015, leading up to the announcement that you hit 1 million. How did engaging with your fan base correlate with your sales?
Our Kickstarter community or crowd that follow us, they're essential to our business. Some of them follow us from campaign to campaign. Some of them skip a campaign. Some of them, you know, buy it after it's available. But all of them provide extremely valuable feedback to us. For example, during the Illuminoodle campaign, we started with a 5-foot-long Illuminoodle. But while we were running the campaign, there were so many requests for a longer Illuminoodle, we actually made it a 10-foot version. We made a new product that we weren't planning on selling or making because of the input we received from the Kickstarter community.
So not only did your Kickstarter backers validate the viability of your product, but they also improved on them.
Yes, definitely. So the 6th Kickstarter campaign, the color-changing Illuminoodle, was a result of a survey we did to our Kickstarter backers. So after every Kickstarter project we do, we make it, we send it out, we wait a couple months, and then we send everyone a survey and we ask them questions. How do they like it? How do they use it? Is there things you don't like? Are there things you would improve upon? And when we did that with the Illuminoodle, there were 4 or 5 features that really stuck out. People really wanted it to change colors. People really wanted it to have an on-off switch. People really wanted it to have a dimmer. And so we took the 5 top things and we incorporated them into a 2nd generation Illuminoodle, the Illuminoodle Color, and launched a Kickstarter campaign that was directly from the feedback of our previous backers.
How many people responded to that survey?
Over 2,000 people, which is incredible, actually. It was over 30% of our customers responded to the survey.
After graduation in 2010 with Paul Slessor, the Power Practical team grew. Caleb Light, now Vice President of Sales at Power Practical since 2011. Wafiq Ali, Director of Sales since 2012. Matt Ford, your CEO since 2013. You guys have stuck together for years now and are still working at Power Practical. What's the key to building a strong, long-term entrepreneurial team?
Building a team is never easy, and particularly in a small company. Probably the most important thing is cultural fit. You know, you have to have similar interests, so you have something to relate to, but you need to have similar work ethics. You just have to all be able to get along.
Did you go camping with these guys before you ended up working together at Power Practical?
Probably most of the people, actually, but not the most recent hires.
I actually met Wafiq Ali while at Mountain View Elementary School for the 2016 electoral primaries earlier this year. And he shared with me that it wasn't until Power Practical had existed for a few years that investors such as venture capitalists didn't care about your products. Once Power Practical was demonstrated to be viable and sustainable in the marketplace, it seemed, based on my conversation with Wafiq, that Power Practical blew up to a new level in the game of business. Could you talk more about the thematic transition between being a small student entrepreneur-run startup to a full-fledged company that demanded more money to grow?
You start the business typically with your own money. And that's what Paul and I did. We each put in a few thousand dollars, and that was enough to kind of prove out whether or not we could make some power pots. So we built some, bought some tools, and we built maybe 50 power pots or something like that. did the Kickstarter campaign, gave us enough money to buy the tools to actually build them in mass here in Salt Lake City in our shop. We sold 1,000, but we had enough money to buy 2,000 pieces worth. It gave us 1,000 pieces of inventory to try and sell to stores. And then the traction from that original Kickstarter campaign is what allowed us to go out into the local entrepreneurship community and raise financing for equity. So we raised money from the Park City Angel Group and Kickstart Seed Fund, both local groups that invest in startups. We raised that money with a premise of taking the Power Pot into brick and mortar retail, so selling it in stores like REI and Cabela's and other outdoor stores. After raising that money, we did successfully get into REI and Cabela's and most of the outdoor stores that would come to mind. And we sold in them for maybe 2 years or so. The issue that we had was we really underestimated how difficult it was to sell in brick and mortar retail.
Why was that?
Because we'd never done it before. So, for example, with REI, they only bought the Power Pot, none of our other products. And when they bought the Power Pot, they put it on the bottom shelf in the store next to the cooking pots. And we wanted them to put it by the solar panels because, in our mind, we're trying to sell people a generator, not a pot. But in the person at REI who was buying it, they wanted to put it with the pots. They wanted to sell it to people that are buying pots and have it double as a generator. And we thought that was completely backwards, but we had no influence over that. We sold into REI, and they sold through all their stuff, and they said it didn't sell fast enough and didn't sell them anymore again. Kind of how it goes, that's learning as an entrepreneur. With Cabela's, it was a really different scenario. Cabela's picked up maybe 5 of our different products and put them all together so we had a little area in the power section of their store. Cabela's, in contrast with REI, was putting in an order every 4 months. So they were selling through. And then the other thing is, you know, how do you get people to go in the store and look for your product? You know, we're not putting ads on TV. We're not Coleman or something like that where it's a household name. So it was really difficult to, one, get people into the store, and then two, in the case of like REI, if they could even find it, because the employees didn't really know about the Power Pot because all we have is one product in their store. The employees don't know every single product. You know, there's 20,000 products and you're asking about one of them. And then I lost my train of thought.
That's really frustrating.
Yeah, it was really frustrating. So then we changed our model. We said, hey, look, we're not doing good at retail. We'll be honest with ourselves. We were very successful in selling in, but not selling through. So let's do what we're good at, which is making new products and selling them on Kickstarter. And since we were good at selling on Kickstarter, our theory was we should be able to sell online well. Why we think we're successful at Kickstarter is we're good at telling the story, like I said before. Someone lands on the page, they can read about it, they get the idea, and that's just not possible in brick and mortar retail. There's no way in retail that you're going to be able to convey all the information to a customer in REI that the same person would receive if they had gone to our Kickstarter page. So we decided we're going to just focus on creating new products, putting them on Kickstarter, and then going to Amazon. Because on Amazon, we can tell more of a story, and it takes a lot less work for us in the sense that we put it up and we can keep our team small. It's not about calling new stores every single day and trying to get more stores to buy Power Pots or any product. We kind of shifted from this old school mentality of let's make products and sell them in stores to let's make products, crowdfund them, and then put them on online retail.
As you're mentioning all this, I'm thinking about how pragmatic that is. And you mention yourself to be a pragmatic person, and no doubt those at Power Practical are extremely pragmatic as well, wherein you're creating a niche and you're making your business scalable.
Yeah. So I guess going back to your original question, why did all some people are really interested in the business? It's because before we didn't know anything about brick and mortar retail, and we made these projections like every company does and says, this is what we think we can do. And every year we did all right. We didn't quite make it as good as we wanted to do, but we didn't totally flop either. No one was upset from the investor community, but no one was excited either. But now this year, that's all changed because we set out in January and we said, here's what we think we can do this year. And then we already exceeded that. So we said, okay, we can do this. And then we exceeded that. So all of a sudden, not only are we making projections that we're hitting and exceeding, but we've created this model where the investors get excited because it's replicable. You can come up with a product, put on Kickstarter, put on Amazon, do that over and over again.
And you have predictable results in terms of what you're bringing in because of that system?
Yeah, from experience and some analytical tools, we can guess pretty well. So these days, there are tools out there on the internet that you can use to look at Amazon pages, for example, and see roughly how many of those products is that page selling per month. And then from that, you can say, okay, if they're selling this many per month, then if I take 50% of it, I should be able to sell this many. So if they're selling 100 and we, after 3 months, we can take 50% of the market because our new product is maybe stronger, more practical, and cheaper, then, you know, logically, we should be able to eat away at the existing product that's already out there. So if they're selling 100, taking 50%, that's not crazy. And we've been able to actually do that and show traction to that method.
Which always makes a venture capitalist very happy. Being an engineer, how did you know when it was time to ask for more money? Did you have the support of your team to let you know when you were going into a new phase, or had you developed that intuition being a startup entrepreneur?
That's something that I think we all came to the realization together with, because you kind of build this plan of what you're going to do. And part of that plan is actual numbers, right? Like this month we're going to sell this many, next month we're going to sell this many more, or whatever. And when you're doing that, there's a cost associated with doing that, especially at least for a business like mine. If you're doing software, it might be a little bit different. Like there's really heavy on the front end where you have to invest a lot of money into human resources to build the program. Once you have that piece of software, it costs nothing to sell it to someone. There's no cost of goods. But for us, it's very obvious, painfully obvious, unfortunately, that as you grow, you just need more money, because the more you're selling, the more money you have to have tied up in product that you're going to sell. So based on these projections that we build, we're able to see, okay, you know, in 3 months, we're going to run out of money, so we need to get a loan now so that we can buy the inventory with a loan instead of our own cash, so we don't go negative, so we can pay ourselves.
Just being very strategic about where you're leveraging money and why.
Yeah, which I certainly learned nothing about in school, but having an engineering mindset, it's pretty easy to build out a spreadsheet and see when the numbers go negative, why they went negative, and what you can do to keep them in the positive.
Let's talk about patents. The year that you went on Shark Tank, you were pending a patent for a passively cooled, lightweight thermoelectric generator system. It was granted by the United States Patent Office in March of 2014. If I'm a student entrepreneur wanting to get a patent on an invention of mine, what steps are essential to take to help get this done?
So the best place to start is with the University of Utah resource. There's a gentleman, I forget his full name, I remember his first name, same as mine, David, who is the Utah State Government Documents Librarian, or some sort of long title like that. Essentially, what he knows how to do very, very well is search through government documents. And one of the things he knows how to do very well is search through the patent database. He will gladly teach you how to search through the database, or you can come to him and say, I have this thing and I want to search and see if there's anything similar. And he'll do it with you, do an example with you, and then you get to learn how to search the patent database. And the reason that's so important is you can't patent something that's already been patented. So step one, see if there's already a patent. And then step two is do a broader search and see if there's something already on the market that's not, doesn't have a patent issued on it or applied for. Because even if it's in the public domain, it still means you can't panic, you can't patent something that's already been invented. And then where to go from there? There's kind of a series of steps to filing a patent. And I can tell you what we do here, which is we come up with an idea, we do this patent search, we dig around, we see, okay, we think this is patentable. We will make the prototype, put it on Kickstarter. And right before we put it on Kickstarter, we file what's called a provisional patent. And a provisional patent is very cheap to file. It's only $150. It doesn't need to be super complicated. A description of the gist of your idea. So you don't need all the lawyer mumbo jumbo legalese stuff in there. You can do that yourself. Then if your Kickstarter campaign goes well, then you have a viable product, and hopefully you have enough money to pay to have a full patent written and apply for it. I write the bulk of the patents that we submit to the patent office. Most of the patent is called the description and the background, where you're describing what you came up with and the state of the industry. You can pay an attorney to do that, but it's going to be really expensive. And then what you need an attorney for is to write the most important parts of the patent, which are the claims, which is what you're actually patenting, and then the abstract and the title of the patent. Step one, check the patent database. Step two, file a provisional patent. Step three, file a utility patent within that 1 year window after filing the provisional patent. And when you file that utility patent, you get to claim priority to the date where you filed your provisional patent. You get to make a $150 bet that you're going to file a patent later. And then if you did do that, then you get to say, I invented this when I filed that provisional patent. So say someone else came out with a product that's very similar to yours during that 1 year period. Doesn't matter because you already have that provisional patent filed.
Why is it essential to patent your product?
Honestly, I wouldn't say it is essential. If you want to patent your product, the most valuable your patent will be to you is if you plan to sell your business or sell that product. There's this kind of perception about patents, which is just not true, that people think a patent provides protection. That's unfortunately not true. Patents do not protect you. They give you the right to go attack someone. So even if you have a patent and someone else is infringing upon your patent, you need to have a lot of money to go after them. If you have enough money to pay a lawyer to file a lawsuit and can quickly become hundreds of thousands of dollars, then you can litigate and protect your invention, so to speak. But you're not really protecting it, right? You're going after someone else. When it comes to selling your business or selling your product along with the IP, then IP is very valuable. And typically someone that is buying your business has the money to go sue people, and then it's valuable to them. But for a startup and for a small company, most of the time you're not going to have the money to go after someone, even if they are infringing. And the other thing is they don't protect you internationally unless you file for international patents, which are very expensive. My recommendation is just go for it and don't worry about filing a patent. I mean, it's good to file a provisional patent. It's good to file a patent if you can, but don't let it stop you from doing what you want to do.
Back in 2012, a Facebook user named Eugene Martin used a PowerPractical PowerPod after their power was shut down in Washington, D.C. from Hurricane Sandy. What impact do you imagine PowerPractical can have on the lives of others?
The PowerPod is a great little survival emergency product. Every catastrophe, natural disaster that happens in the U.S. pretty much, we'll get some pictures of people using the PowerPod, usually on their gas range inside their house, and the power's out. Something that we explored early on was what impact could the PowerPod have in emerging markets, third world, if you will, where people don't have access to power like we do here. We did some case studies and got some really interesting results, like a guy in Madagascar. He bought some charcoal and was on the beach and was boiling seawater and charging people's phones and was able to make enough money to pay for the charcoal and then have money left over. So he was like profitably running this little micro business off boiling seawater. And I think he was selling some other stuff at his kiosk and then charging people's phone and charging them, you know, a quarter for it or something like that. But what we end up finding out is it's really, really difficult to create a sustainable business in these emerging markets where the price point has to be really low. You can't go in there and give things to people because that ends up destroying their local economy for that product. So, for example, there's a group called Solar Sisters. We talked to them early on. Women in Africa who are selling solar panels, and they sell them to other people in the community, and then they can use them to provide light or charge their cell phones. The founder of Solar Sisters really cautioned us against doing the so-called TOMS model, because she'd been in communities where TOMS comes in, drops off a whole bunch of shoes, kills the whole cobbler shoemaking market there. All the shoes wear out because they're not that great. And then there's no market, there's no industry there anymore making shoes. And then they're worse off than when they started. We did explore trying how we could do kind of a sustainable emerging market play with the PowerPot, but we needed our price point to come down by like 50% for people to be able to afford it and build a sustainable model.
You are the co-founder of Power Practical, as much as you are currently looking over product design and development for the company. What's down the pike with regards to innovation at Power Practical?
We plan on getting a lot more aggressive about designing and launching new products. Proven out this year, this kind of Kickstarter to Amazon model. And next year, we want to do more Kickstarter projects for more ambitious products.
What products are you working on that you're really excited about?
You're going to have to stay tuned to Kickstarter to find out.
Very cool. David, thanks for showing students and entrepreneurs everywhere how innovation is done.
You're very welcome, Jay. Thanks for having me.
You can check out Power Practical's products at www.powerpractical.com. To learn more about entrepreneurship at the University of Utah Lausanne Entrepreneurship Institute, visit lausanne.utah.edu. I'm Jay Abubo, and thanks for listening. Remember, entrepreneurs, stay resilient and stay gold.